and welcome to another Ag Econ MT podcast episode, part of the Ag Econ MT project website and a production of the Department of Agricultural Economics and Economics at Montana State University. I'm Anton Beckerman, and today we have a very special guest, Dr. Alphonse Wiersing, who is chatting with us all the way from Waikato, New Zealand, where he is currently on sabbatical. So, hi, Alphonse. Thanks for joining
us. You're welcome.
Dr. Wiersing is a professor of economics at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. His research focuses, so he's not in New Zealand all the time, don't be that jealous. His research focuses on the interaction of technological innovation and foreign policy on farm-level decisions and how those decisions play out in a broader ag supply chain context. And even though he's usually in Canada, he does have a very special connection to the Northern Great Plains. He completed his Master's of Applied Economics right here at Montana State University. So he's a Bobcat, everyone, for the rest of his life. So today, we're going to chat about a topic that encapsulates a lot of his research, this growing non-uniformity or heterogeneity among farms. And he's looked at these issues throughout his tenure at Guelph and looked at how technology has and agricultural policy has potentially impacted this growing heterogeneity. And the way to think about it is there are fewer farms today, and they've grown. And there are fewer farms today that look like one another relative to, say, 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. And, you know, farms have consolidated over the past century in North America and other developed economies. And this has resulted in fewer but larger operations. So the question is, if there are fewer farms than in the past and they're larger and technology is evolved and everyone has big tractors and big combines, Why don't these farms operate and make decisions or just look like one another? And that's what we really want to dig into today. It's definitely happening in the Northern Great Plains. It's happening in other parts of the country. It's happening all over the world. So really important and interesting issues to kind of think about and look at. And so we'll talk about that. He's going to tell us a little bit about why this has happened and things to look forward to in the next 30 or 40 or 50 years, and what factors might play a role in going forward. So Alphonse, let's start with this. Before we dive into, you know, talking about heterogeneity or non-uniformity across farms and their implications, tell us what farm structure looked like 30 or 40 or 50 years ago when farms were more homogeneous. Why did that happen? What was going on back then?
Well, when I grew up on the farm, all the farms were very similar. We had a single farmer operating a single farm that supported a single farm family. And generally, that farm family was not as well off compared to not only their urban counterparts, but their non-farm rural counterparts. They were poor. And that generated the idea, the public support for helping these people out. And we had extension programs that helped the ability of the farmer. We had price support programs that raised the output from the revenue from the farm. And ultimately, that fed into supporting that farm family. And they tended to be mixed operations. They tended to be ones with the farmer working full-time on the farm, the spouse, the family members, heavily involved in the farm operation. And all these farms were very much alike, whether they were a mixed grain operation or whether they were a dairy operation growing some crops for market and for feed. You know, if you went down the country road, farms tended to look like one another within a region.
Why is that? Is it that everyone kind of had the same philosophy about farming? Is it that the policies were targeted in such a way to encourage homogeneity and sort of uniformity? What was different back then relative to, say, now?
I think that the technology, the way that existed at that time, the programs that existed at that time, and just the general view of the role of of women, for example, and the differences in economic structure between rural and urban regions, that a family unit like that was the most efficient way of operation. And a mixed unit also served to diversify the portfolio as well. So literally not all their eggs were in one basket.
Mm-hmm. When did this start to change? So we know that now we're in a different state than we were before. So what was the spark that caused this to start going into the modern agricultural landscape that we're in right now?
Yeah, I don't know whether there was a single spark, but I think the innovations that the research and development that has been aided by government and by private organizations have resulted in a rapid increase in productivity within the farm sector. You know, this rate of increase is outstanding. You know, and it outstrips the productivity increases in most other sectors, and it's allowed for this movement off the farm. And since absolute level of production has not changed very much, it's meant that fewer farmers have to produce that total amount of supply.
What about some of the financial stresses that happen? I'm not as familiar with the Canadian ag economy, but I know here in the United States, you know, the late 1980s were a real mess financially, and you had quite a bit of farm exits and bankruptcies, and that I've seen in some literature pointed to as one of the aspects that has driven, you know, some heterogeneity to happen. That those farms that exited were, you know, maybe looked the same, but they were also less efficient or whatever. And so some of these financial stresses that occur that lead to farm exits, that has potentially that could lead to this heterogeneity happening.
Yeah. Yeah, ironically, after I graduated from Montana State, I ended back in Ontario, and the plan was for me to farm full time, but I started working in a bank as a credit manager for the ag sector, and then farming part time with my brother and father. And it happened to be in the middle of the farm financial crisis, and I know full well what it was like in the ag sector because essentially what we were doing was foreclosing or consolidating loans. And it wasn't a pleasant time. However, looking back at the actual number of bankruptcies and the actual number of exits, it did not increase during that time period significantly. It's like we have had a 1.5% decline in the number of farms every year. And it's steady. And in poor times, we do have some people who feel the pressures to exit. When prices are high and land prices are high, some people say, well, I'm going to sell out now. And so it's surprising. It's just been really a steady decline in the number of farms over time. And there haven't been these peaks or valleys during high prices or low prices. It's just, I think, a steady accumulation of all these factors. Mm-hmm.
When you say heterogeneity or non-uniformity across farms that we see much more now, how are they different? Is one farm using a different technology? Are they making different decisions? What is different about these farms? What kind of factors can we look at to say, oh, you know, this is how this farm is different from another one?
Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to capture within, let's say, two categorizations, but I think it is broadly into commodity agriculture versus niche agriculture. And so either you are producing number two yellow corn or grade A milk, or you are producing, caged eggs caged eggs would be a commodity, cage-free eggs would be a niche. And organic, local, all these different adjectives that somehow represent a niche, represent a profit opportunity for somebody. And it's not necessarily big versus small, because you have to be big, in order to supply organic produce to Walmart, you have to be big. So, but I think broadly, it's niche versus commodity would be the two. And in commodity, they tend to be specialized and large. And niche, they tend to be smaller and a bit more diversified, I would argue.
Yeah. So one of the, and our conversation was initially stemmed by a paper that was published in the Canadian Journal of Agricultural Economics. And correct me if I'm wrong, it's from your fellow's address from the Canadian meetings that happened, I think, this past year. And one of the things that you point out in that paper is that it's actually the mid-sized farms that have experienced the most change. So why is that? Why are the very small farms still successful, or maybe don't look that much different as they were 40 or 50 years ago? Why are the bigger farms different? Why has the mid-sized farm kind of gone out of favor?
Yeah, I think the mid-sized farm faces pressure to either get big because the margins on commodity production are small. And so if you're making $50 an acre, you need to be growing a lot of acres in order to generate sufficient funds for the family. In contrast, so they might decide, well, I'm going to either focus on niche, which takes more effort, and they might downsize that way, or they might downsize because they're going to look for some off-farm work opportunities. So we've had this push to farms to move out of that mid-size area. And this hollowing out of the middle is not unique to the farm sector. You could look at a number of different sectors within the agri-food sector and or components of the agri-food sector, and you would notice the same thing. Grocery stores, for example, you know, you've got a couple very big ones, and then you've got a little smaller independent. Abattoirs, same thing. You've got one or two major beef packers, but then you've got a lot of smaller abattoirs. The beer sector, a couple major breweries, and then all these craft brewers that have popped up. This hollowing out of the middle is not unique to the farm sector. I think what, maybe the analogy to the craft beer sector might be a useful one to think of, because what we have seen recently in the ag sector is an increase in the number of small farms, and they are producing these niche commodities. And, people, ag has become cool again. Food is interesting. People want to know where their food is coming from. And a lot of people have responded to that by, I've got a bit of land. I'm going to get into this business. So,
yeah. And just to give you a little bit of context. So, if you look back into the late 1970s, there were maybe 20 to 30 craft breweries in the United States. The last figure that I saw for maybe a year or two ago, it's close to about 4,500. So just in about 40 years, you have this humongous increase. And I think a lot of it is driven by the millennial consumer, the demand for more information about food, which, from my experience and from my conversations with folks in the wheat sector, that's really concerning to them, because it's very difficult to trace wheat from where it began to where it ends up because of all the mixing and blending and quality components. But I think, that sector, for example, will likely have to adjust because it has no choice. That's what the consumers that are emerging as the primary income earners and income spenders, that's what they seem to want.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
How's this changed the market structure and this idea of market consolidation? So this either you're either niche or you're not niche and you're commodity, and you said that this happens all across the supply channel. In terms of, I know a lot of people are think of things like market power and monopoly and oligopoly and monopsony and oligopsony. So the consolidation of market power. Is this what's been happening? Is this how has this changed the broader agricultural production and marketing landscape?
I think it in terms of size and the concern about, you know, monopoly or monopsony, the farm level is still so small. Like, you know, some people have argued, why aren't farms even bigger than they are? And it's also important to note, just as a sidebar, that 98% of the farms are family operated, that there's not outside institutional investors. It's still a very small component. So even though they're a corporation for tax reasons and there might be several families involved, it's not, it's still a family-based operation at heart for most of these farms. What has changed in terms of market structure is the use of contracts. We used to sell commodities on auction markets. You used to bring, beef farmers brought their cattle to the auction, and the highest bidder got the cattle. Corn farmers sell their corn, bring it to the local elevator, and the merchant looks at what's happening on the Chicago futures and gives them the price, adjusting for a local. That is when you have a homogeneous product. The most efficient way to sell it is through an auction market, a spot market. In contrast, if you have wheat that is going to be produced for a craft brewery, they want certain characteristics grown in a certain way. And as a result, they just can't go to the local elevator and give me some. They have to contract directly with the farmer. If a retailer is going to be selling cage-free eggs, they've got to contract directly with the farmer to have that attribute delivered. And so I think the bigger shift in terms of market is not in terms of market power, but in terms of the way that the goods are sold, moving away from a spot market to a contract, to contracts. And it's changed the risk to the farmer. Now, instead of price risk being the big issue for those farmers, it's now contract risk. What happens at the end of 3 years when my contract is up? Maybe that retailer now wants to go to somebody else, and then I'm left without my market. So,
yeah, and one of the things that I've noticed in at least Montana's organic industry, and I think this is true in other organic industries and sectors across the country. Speaking of niche small farm markets, is their biggest concern and their biggest uncertainty is contract and whether they have a contract. And a lot of the producers that say that, look, I'm not sure whether I'm going to be successful, it's those that don't have contracts. And those that do, they're the ones that are most successful in these niche markets. So I think you're absolutely right. So speaking of how things have changed and where they're going, at the conclusion or at the end, toward the end of your paper, your talk, you talk about these eight implications for resulting from farm heterogeneity and kind of going forward over the next 20, 30, 40 years. And the first four, so let's break them up. So the first four are talking about more of the impacts of policy and the design of policy. Can you talk about those first, and then we'll come back to the other four, which are more to do with production and farm management decisions. So policy, how is that going to impact where we go over the next 30, 40 years?
Well, this talk was, this paper was largely motivated by a situation where we were assessing the financial conditions of farmers in Ontario in 2012. And this was a period of sort of in the middle of the commodity price boom, you know, that started in late 2007 and continued to 2014. And we were assessing the financial situation. And on average, farmers were losing money. Their return relative to their sales was negative, which meant that they were suffering negative farm income and very high percentage losses, you know. And so we thought, what's going on? So we took a deeper look at it, and we found that farms who were selling less than 100,000 were losing money on average. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember that this was not their main source of income, whereas those that were selling more than 100,000, they had positive returns and were doing well, which supported the view that if you just looked in the countryside, there were a lot of brand new pickups and a lot of brand new equipment. So what it does mean is that you can't just look at the average farmer anymore to decide what's going on in the sector, because we don't know who that average is. If you take that middle and that middle is shrinking, they're not really representative of what's happening at either end of the continuum. So that's one thing. It's difficult to know who is the average and who do you, to assess whether you need policy or not. The second now issue is that I think it's much more difficult to determine what is the aim of food policy. 40 years ago is we wanted to help that farm family because they were poor. We wanted to get that farmer, improve their management ability. We wanted to help out that the farm, and there were different ways of doing so. Now we don't know whether we want to, you know, support, do we want to support farm incomes? Do we want to improve the competitiveness of the sector? Should we focus on the on commodity or niches, small, large? I think the aim of the policy is much more difficult to establish now than when we had a homogeneous sector. A third is that I think there are going to be more internal pressures from the ag sector for change than external. And let me give you an example. This is something that the farmers in the Great Plains would be aware of, is the Canadian Wheat Board existed for a number of years as a single desk selling agency. So a farmer in Indian Head or Vauxhall, Alberta, they grew wheat, but they didn't know how to market it. So, and they were very much the same. So let's pool our efforts and let some expert sell it for us. And that was good because what was good for the farmer in Indian Head was good for the farmer in Vauxhall. What has happened now is that with technology and the heterogeneity, some farmers can feel like they can do better outside the system, and they can. And so they push for change. And that heterogeneity has meant that we've had a movement away from some of these policies that were meant for everybody when everybody looked fairly similar. And then I think a fourth issue is that this targeting is going to extend to agro-environmental policies. I think that the ability to see what individuals are producing, see how they are producing it, and the ability to verify it, I think we're going to see more targeting of policies than we have in the past. In the past, a typical agro-environmental policy in North America has been to, we have a cost share program. We know these practices are beneficial for the environment. They're going to reduce nutrient runoff. They're going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we'll give you 50% of the cost of purchasing the associated machinery or planting, whatever the cost may involve. So I think we're going to see a shift away from that to some more targeted agro-environmental issues. And as well, I think the big guys now, they're viewed more like a you hear this, a factory farm. And so, you know, factories get taxed with the amount of emissions that come out. Farms might appear to have the same thing. They might not generate the same sort of public support as in the past.
What about things that affect farm management production? You talk about sort of the big data, which has been a buzzword. What are we expecting in closer to the farm level impacts and where we're going?
Well, maybe just to continue with that agro-environmental issue, I think that this in big data is that I think the measurement issue is going to increase for individual farms. That for those that are producing for niche markets, there's going to be continued measurement to verify that these positive attributes are being delivered. For those larger commodity farms, I think they are going to face more measurement issues to verify that they are not doing certain things that have negative effects on the environment or on animal welfare. So they're going to have to prove that continually. So I think this measurement issue is going to be on both sets of farms.
Who's responsible for measuring and for understanding how to use these data? Is it going to fall on the shoulders of the farmers to really up their knowledge about what data are, how to use them, how to collect them, how to manage them? Or is it going to be outsourced to, say, researchers or government agencies or private companies to manage the data? Because I think there's really this this balance between data privacy and who generates the data versus who owns it and who can make decisions about it. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that I think there's a couple aspects here, because there's a lot of data that are generated currently by farms on commodity farms. So let's say this yield data that farmers have been collecting for, you know, two decades anyhow, you know, and who owns that? So that and that is a separate issue, I think, than the data that might be forced to be collected for these niches, saying, whether it be a retailer or a processor saying, we want this and this has to be provided. And so in that sense, it's coming from the consumer end down to the farmers. And some farm groups, I think, are taking a proactive response to say, hey, listen, you know, some of these animal welfare measures, they've gone too far. Here are some more ones that aren't as costly and satisfy your needs. So I think in terms of setting what those attributes might be, sometimes it's coming from top down, but I think that the farm groups can also be involved in setting the agenda in terms of what are appropriate attributes.
Yeah, and just an example closer to home, some of the big brewers, Miller Coors and InBev, they have been, and Walmart as well, they've really been pushing this idea of, we want to know exactly how much energy goes in, how much environmental impacts happen. And it seems like, you know, the barley producers here in Montana, at least, that those are the ones that I know, they're really starting to respond. They're saying, look, we're willing to understand our production methods more and understand the data that we produce and, you know, potentially make changes that would satisfy some of these demands. So I agree. I think farmers they understand that these changes are coming, and they, like you said, they're coming from the consumer end of things.
Yeah.
So other than the data aspects, what else?
I think another thing that we will see is a growing separation of ownership and management. You look back at, you know, when a single farmer operated a single farm and supported a single farm family, that farmer tended to own all the assets. And now in Canada and the United States, about 40% of the farmland is rented. So somebody else is owning that land and renting it back to the farmers. And I think we're going to see more of that because the size and the complexity of these operations make it difficult to sell. And so only the largest would be able to purchase it. It also makes it more difficult to transfer between generations. You know, if you have, 50 years ago, you know, if there were four siblings and Anton was the one who's going to remain on the farm, the other three siblings said, good on you, Anton. We're glad that somebody's back on the farm. We want it seen, kept it in the family. But now when that farm is worth a lot of money, you know, in terms of the asset values have grown tremendously, that now those three siblings are saying, we're not going to give Anton any break on this. And there's just, you know, horror stories in terms of intergenerational transfer. So what you might see is that farm family either selling it outright or keeping it as an investment and but renting out the operation. So I think we're going to see more of that. And also for the individual operation, they're going to need to lease out more of their assets. Because or their services equipment, because that would put them under too much financial risk to borrow all the money to purchase all those assets. So I think that's another change that we'll see.
As they're buying these bigger assets and much more technologically advanced assets, you also discuss in your paper that this is going to require that farmers and operators, they increase their technical skills. They increase both their how they operate those combines and those tractors, and how they manage the both the operation and the economic aspects of this. Can you talk more about what that educational and technical skills part, how that's going to become even more relevant over the next several decades?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if I look back at my father, he was successful because he was just able to work really hard, you know, and now the skill set has broadened so that, my nephews who are farming, they need a whole broader range of skill set. You know, you mentioned financial, you mentioned production, computer related, with robotic milkers, being able to fix a computer is what you need. And also, I think that there are several other skills that, I would argue human resource management in particular is one that that farmers are going to need to in order to be successful. You know, how do you attract labor into the farm sector? How do you keep them and motivate them is difficult for most farmers, and something that they'll have to learn more as they want to continue to grow. And on the other end, you know, these smaller farms, many of them that are getting into the sector, they're from outside traditional farm families. You know, the larger ones, it's being passed on generally from one generation to the next. These smaller farms, these are new people. These are, bright-eyed new university grads with, the high lofty ideals, and they are mid-range people that want to change. So it's a variety of people that don't have the same sort of knowledge base, and they're coming into this sector very energetic and lots of enthusiasm, but I think there's a room for just the basic skill sets of production agriculture that would need to be taught to that sector or that component.
So different sets of skills that are needed to both ends of the spectrum, whether you're large or small. So let's wrap up with this. This is completely unrelated to this paper, but this is just out of my personal curiosity. What are you seeing and how are things different in New Zealand relative to North America, ag or non-ag related?
Well, the ag related stuff is interesting. This, you're probably aware that in the mid 1980s, New Zealand government was facing a huge budget deficit crisis. And so they decided to cut all public support to every sector, including the farm sector. And so they went from being very heavily subsidized to being, on their own. And they are championing free trade because they have a particularly competitive dairy sector based on grazing. I think what's interesting, what I've found out, is that they're facing some pressures now because of environmental regulations. They haven't really faced those before, but there are some beautiful lakes and around that are feeling the effects of and some of the growth in the dairy sector. And there's been some backlash, some tension between those. The other is this, what I mentioned, the growing separation of ownership and management, that 40% of the farmland is rented in North America. It's less than 10% here. And I think it has something to do with the it's been a livestock base, and livestock farmers want, the farm next to them. They can't rent something that's far away. Whereas grain farmer, they can have a farm here and rent something 10 miles down the road. Those would be two changes or two differences that are pretty striking.
Yeah, and of course the third one, which you didn't mention, but I will because I'm currently feeling the effects of it, is, when it's 85 degrees and warm in New Zealand, it's approximately, 10 degrees here and just snowed. So you didn't mention that, but it should be mentioned. So thanks so much, Alphonse, for talking with us and really providing some insight on some really important and interesting things that are that have been happening and are going to continue to happen in most North American agricultural sectors. So it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, and thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, and of course, if you enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can find the entire archive on our AgEconMT.com website, and we post weekly blogs about things that are happening in the Northern Great Plains, so check those out to increase your knowledge, of course. And with that, without further ado, as always, may the weather be in your favor.